Hello, you're listening to Sean from Galactic Chat, and today I'm interviewing the award-winning Dr. Lisa Hannett, prolific writer of The Weird and creative writing academic. Welcome to the podcast, Lisa.
Thanks, Sean.
Now, I'm sure many of our listeners are eager to hear about your upcoming mosaic novel, Lament for the Afterlife, slated for release in 2015 from Chosine. It's not the first mosaic novel you've been involved with, but first, what can you tell us about what to expect?
Well, I think that this one is going to be quite different from the previous mosaic that I wrote with Angela Slater. So this one is a book that's set in a war-torn world. So it's not post-apocalyptic. It is right smack bang in the middle of the apocalypse, I guess you could say. This war has been going on endlessly. So the novel follows the story of a character named Peter, who basically has to do something horrible in chapter one that he then spends the rest of the book trying to come to terms with. So it's a dark fantasy slash war story, I guess, for lack of a better way of describing it. Think kind of Pan's Labyrinth meets Platoon, and that's what the book is going to be like. So it's sort of a mosaic novel in that the novel will jump from different characters' perspectives, but unlike the one that Angela and I wrote, which was really, you know, could have been advertised as a collection of short stories, could be advertised as a mosaic novel, this one really relies on the main character Peter's story following through from chapter one all the way through to the end. So in that respect, you really kind of have to read it in order, and you know, you can't dip in and out as much, reading each chapter as if they're stories. But yeah, so it's war, dark fantasy, and rather bleak. I mean, the title is Lament for the Afterlife, and so, you know, it kind of does what it says on the can.
No, well, I'm intrigued. Well, no, that should be good.
I hope so. Fingers crossed. I really quite like it. It was. It sounds weird saying that such a bleak book was fun to write, but I don't know. I find I really like war stories, so I was really quite caught up writing this one, even though it is relentlessly sad.
Okay. Well, I know you have a liking for a certain book by Michael Crummy.
Oh,
and
yes.
That's a bit morbid in places.
Oh, yeah. Everyone should read that book, Galore, by Michael Crummy. And it is just wonderful, but also has some really good sad parts. I don't know. I'm attracted to, obviously, dark and bleak stories. That one has probably quite a lot of light moments as well, but all in all, I find that it's quite moving, dark folklore as well.
Well, I thought I'd better let you get in your commission for selling his book.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks.
No, that's all right. I bought it 2 years ago, and shamefully, I haven't read it yet. Oh. But my other half has, so anyway, I'm going to read it this Christmas.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Now, we'll talk about you, seeing we're interviewing you, not Michael Crummy.
Yeah, but, I'll be Michael Crummy's spokeswoman.
Okay, moving on to my next question. You're an award-winning short story writer, but not every short story writer aspires to write novels. And I was thinking, you just told me that this mosaic novel is a bit different to other mosaic novels. But what I was thinking is mosaic novels seem to mix the best of both forms.
Yeah.
And I wondered what does a mosaic novel, and you could talk about your Lament for the Afterlife or the other ones you've written, what does that allow you to do that you don't currently do with or have done with short fiction?
I think that, well, with obviously, I mean, this is going to sound so obvious, but when you're doing a mosaic novel, you can explore a lot more because it's so much bigger. But at the same time, I guess it requires, at least when I think about it, it requires each chapter to be really sharp the way that a short story is. So in that respect, it's, you know, the kind of technique and the style in which you're writing, I approach them as kind of extended short stories. But also a really good example, I think, of a mosaic novel is Things We Didn't See Coming by Stephen Amsterdam. who's an Australian author, so hooray, I'm not just spruiking Canadians on this podcast. But it's really interesting because his novel is advertised as a novel, but also as a collection of short stories. And essentially, I think why it's so important that his story and the one that I'm telling are told in the way that they are is that it allows you to kind of skip over big periods of time. So it kind of unsettles the reader a little bit in that they read through the first chapter and think, in a traditional novel, the next chapter would kind of pick up, you know, in a similar time or with a similar character. Or even if it's jumping to a different perspective, you know, you're getting situated in the world and it's a little bit more comfortable rather than feeling so unsettling. But with Things We Didn't See Coming, as soon as you finish that first chapter and you think, okay, now I know who my protagonist is, it jumps and it goes into a different time and you have to kind of find your feet again. And if you're writing something that is unsettling, if you're intending for the book to not be a comfortable read, then I guess that, for me, is one way of doing it, is approaching it with this kind of mosaic structure instead of a straightforward, traditional kind of chronological narrative. So, yeah, I guess for me it's a bit about the style and structure as well as playing with gaps in time. And so you get to have a lot of character development. So Peter, my protagonist, grows over a number of years and travels quite far in the space of a novel, which if I had tried to spell all of that out in a traditional kind of chronological sense, then the book could have been 800 pages long or, you know, could have been split into a trilogy or more. I don't know. But it allowed me to kind of jump over the quiet parts of his life and get back to some of the more, you know, fraught events.
I like that you're talking about there about the you could have made an expansive novel, which you maybe an agent would have gone, yes, that's a great idea.
Yeah. But
in some ways, it's good to read some really tight stylistic writing, I think, and almost get a bit more taste in what you're reading, if taste is the right word.
Yeah.
You know.
And I guess it is. It's the kind of thing where it can be exhausting. I know Angela and I have talked about this before, where, you know, when you're writing a short story, you can really hone in on that kind of style and the language can be dense and lush because you're not requiring, you know, you're not asking the reader to stick with you for 300 pages. So in that respect, when you do a novel in this kind of mosaic sense, you are constantly asking the reader to be paying attention the whole time. And, you know, if, as I read before bed and you kind of get tired, you know, and your mind wanders and you find that your eyes are moving along the page, but you're not really taking the words in it. You kind of, you know, this book is the kind of thing where you might have to go back and reread that page, otherwise you'll miss some info. But yeah, I really like that it is a little bit more of an intense, demanding reading experience.
I'm writing poetry, as you may know, so I don't have any problems with people that want to go and get you know, involved in the language, so to speak.
And that's, I find poetry, I love speculative poetry. I mean, I love all poetry, really, but, you know, there's some really great speculative poets out there that I'm sure you've read some of them, like Helen Marshall and Amal El-Motar, Claire Cooney as well. You know, so it is about the language, and it's about immersing yourself in that really precise language and reading between the lines. And I am not a great poet, but I think that I find that aesthetic really appealing, and so when I approach short stories, that's probably as close to being a poet as I'll ever get. But I really admire what people can achieve with so few words.
Oh, yeah. No, I do. I do enjoy the extra effort, yeah, that some of our top writers go to have that extra emphasis on language.
But don't you think that is it? What marks some stories or some novels as being the ones that you remember, even if you don't really like the storyline per se, or, you know, you found the world was kind of meh or whatever, but the ones that really stick with you, regardless of whether you like the whole package, are the ones that have the beautiful writing, that pay as much attention to the crafting of the story and, you know, the way that the thing is structured and the way the words are put together on the page, as, you know, things like plot and character and all that. I mean, I love a good action-y, you know, fluffy kind of airport novel as much as the next person, especially on Christmas holidays. But the ones that really resonate and that you think about for a really long time are the ones that where you go, wow, that person has just crafted an amazing sentence, or holy, I would have never thought of that metaphor before. Wow, that was so cool. Those are the sorts of things that I think really make writers rise to the top.
I think so, and I've become a bit more aware of it this year because I set out to read quite a bit of short fiction, mm-hmm. and it is interesting. You can there's you know, generally in Australia there's quite a few competent writers
of
short stories or novels, but when you read all of those stories in sort of one big hit, you really notice. Sometimes when you say, for example, if I read Bluegrass Symphony, it's all your work in one hit, and you go, well, you know, that was a great read. And but when you're getting those stories interspersed amongst other writers, that I think that's where you really start to see the difference. So it becomes like starkly different.
Where
somebody's a good proficient. Exponent of language that you can really enjoy it, and that's what I've found reading this year is that there's, like you say, there's been those stories which, for all intents and purposes, good story, you know, enjoyed it, mm-hmm. and then you get somebody, and it varies from different readers, I'm sure, but you'll get somebody and you'll go, oh, that was lovely,
yeah,
that was, you know, and it's got something a little bit extra, so
I was just thinking about this sort of thing this morning driving into town, and it's kind of like I really love that beautiful writing. So like what you were just describing, when you read something and you just go, oh, that was so lovely. Even if, or especially if, the story, the subject matter itself is not lovely. So, you know, if it's something kind of harrowing, described with the perfect phrases or just in such a gorgeous way that you just go, wow, that tension between that horrific subject matter and this gorgeous writing. I really like that. But then the other side of the coin, and what I was thinking about today, is having really excellent ideas or a really cool concept or just something so smart or, you know, mind-blowing expressed in a really straightforward and plain way. Like, not plain as in bad or, you know, poorly written or anything, but just without going into that kind of metaphorical, dense, poetic kind of language, but just saying things in such a straightforward way that it's really stark. And I was thinking of Levi Tidhar's work. That's what this is what made me start thinking along these lines, is that, you know, his ideas are so huge and so, you know, tied up with history and really important issues, but the way that he writes them, the structure of the books are really, you know, interesting and not necessarily the straightforward chronology kind of story, but the writing itself is really transparent and really, you know, quite clear and simple in a good way. And so it's kind of the contrast there is between these really heavy ideas and then just really straightforward prose. So I think if you can pull that off as well, then that's something else that I find really impressive. So it's kind of like from one extreme to the other, the really kind of baroque, wonderful, you know, you can practically see the red velvet on the words kind of writing, and then the other just really stark writing, which I really admire as well. I think The Road by Cormac McCarthy is another one. That's what I'm trying to describe with that kind of stark. You know, sometimes there's metaphors and stuff in The Road that are just like, wow. But more often than not, it's just about this really sharp, short, kind of almost fragmented writing. And I think that that's really hard to pull off.
Yeah, and I was just thinking then where you're talking about that starkness. Yeah, in that it might not just be, I suppose you're choosing your subject matter and you're going, you know,
what is going to suit, like what subject matter and what style are going to work most effectively to convey what you're trying to say? Like, I think that's something that I think about quite a lot. And I think, you know, there are so many ways that you can tell a story, obviously. But when you think, okay, I want to tell this story about the Holocaust or whatever, what is the most effective or new or jarring or, you know, whatever kind of, what are you trying to convey by telling this story, and how can your structure and style emphasize that or, you know, kind of subtly or, you know, really over the top? So I think that it is really important to think about the way in which the story is told, obviously writers, everyone will say that, but the way in which the story is told as much as what you're saying.
I've just got a shiver down my back. You made me remember, I think it was Karen Warren's first story that she ever got published.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an example, I think, of what we're talking about, where it's a really horrific tale.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of it, but it's told by the protagonist who this incident happens to. It's told in such a sort of straightforward way that you're constantly anticipating the terror that's going to come next. I think it's probably the best story that I've read of hers. I think.
Cool. Everyone should go and look it up. Look up Karen's website.
I'll have to dig it up again because I'm pretty sure it was the first one that she ever had published. It chilled me more than anything she's ever written.
Cool.
Because it was so believable, and that's the sort of horror that I.
Mm-hmm.
Or yeah, the dark stuff that gets to me. But I've got a question about that coming up later
okay.
on. So I won't talk any more about that because I want to cover that next. But all right. So with Lament for the Afterlife, mm-hmm. what was the impetus behind it? Was there a narrative there that just demanded more telling? Was it you couldn't fit what you wanted to say into a short space?
Yes, I think it was a bigger story than what I could fit into one and feel satisfied or feel that I was done with telling that story. The real drive to write it was just speculating about war. And I'm quite attracted to stories that deal with the futility of war. So not trying to, come at it from a hero's perspective or looking at what happened afterwards or whatever, but just, long wars that are being fought and no one is going to win. This is what I'm saying. It's a bleak book. But so these are the sorts of things that I'm perpetually interested in, or at least I haven't gotten sick of thinking about it yet. So thinking about why the wars keep going on, will there ever be an end? And I'm not thinking of one in particular, but lots of different wars kind of inspired this book, like Vietnam War, what's going on. Well, gosh, what's going on all the time, really? It just seems like some wars just will never be won. And this is probably also, it has only just this second occurred to me, that that's probably stemming from my interest, this is going to sound strange, but stemming from my interest in Icelandic sagas as well, where, the Vietnam War has nothing to do with medieval Iceland, but in a lot of the sagas that I study and write about, there are these feuds between families, and basically the only way that these feuds end is when everyone dies. So, you end up with one or two survivors out of long lines of families that have ended up killing each other off because of various slights and things that have led to the feud escalating until basically everybody dies. And the last two survivors kind of go, okay, I think that we're done with this now. So I guess that's the kind of thing where, in my mind, so many of these huge wars either just keep going or it has to be that everyone dies. Otherwise, they're never going to stop. And I know that that's really a simplistic view, but these are the sorts of things that I was like, well, I really want to explore some of these ideas and why do these things happen and what would happen if we're telling the story in the middle of what seems to be a never-ending war. And so that, to me, all seemed to be way too big to fit into just one story or even a long short story. There was just so much more I wanted to explore, and so it started to grow into a much bigger book.
Well, yeah, I guess you'd have to get that sense of sort of a long sort of, long never-ending war. You do tend to have to...
Yeah, you have to show that.
Stretch the exit, yeah.
I mean, there's only so much kind of explanation or info dumping you can do. Like, the war has been going on for years. I'm all about showing and not telling. So, yeah, it requires a few more thousand words than what you're allowed in a short story to kind of show the ongoing effect of these kind of wars. So, and also just exploring how this has affected one family. So it's essentially Peter, the main character, but then his parents and his sisters as well. They're all, brought into the sphere of the story.
Okay, well, I'm excited about it. It's
hooray!
You know, it does sound interesting. but I wonder if this might be like a Commonwealth readers sort of approach, or even maybe just the Commonwealth. But I'm just thinking, particularly here in Australia, we have at times a reverence. Not for the act of war, but there seems to be, certainly in Australia, people have called it almost like a cult of remembrance, and so there's this great interest in war, and I just wonder if that's something that exists all over the Commonwealth, that you've got that sort of reverence, So I was just that was a question that just appealed. Came up to me then. What do you think?
Well,
think about
possibly.
That?
I mean, it's hard because obviously from Canada, I am from another Commonwealth country, and I've been here for a long time now. And there are, all the Remembrance Day things, and there could be something to that. And I think that is something that I kind of explore in the book as well. I'm really interested in memory and remembering and how cultures perpetually remember, various events. So there's a lot of that in the storyline as well. So I don't know if it is because of the kind of Commonwealth perspective or just a kind of fatigue with, watching the news and seeing so many endless horrible wars happening. I'm not really sure where, what kind of stance I'm taking in that respect.
Okay, it'll be up to us to read it and suggest, perhaps.
Yeah. Exactly. I'm more than happy for you to do that.
No worries. All right, well, changing gear a bit. You're not content to relax. In addition to your lecturing at Flinders, you are releasing, or by the time this goes to air, you will have released another collaborative effort with Dr. Angela Slater.
Yep.
And that's The Female Factory, one of the 12 Planet series from 12 Planet Press. What particular excited you about that project, and what do you hope it delivers beyond, just straight entertainment?
Well, what excites me about the project? I'll tackle that part first. Well, the 12 Planet series, first of all, I think is really exciting. So I think I can speak for Angela in this as well, in saying that we were both really excited to be part of the larger project as well. So not just obviously having another opportunity to work together, which we always enjoy, but to be part of this great series of collections of short stories by women. And, so many of them have just been brilliant. I've been getting my hands on all of them. So that was exciting. And I know that Elisa and Angela and I had been talking about us doing a collection for a while, so it was, there was all that excitement of just being part of that. And then there was the challenge that Elisa threw down the gauntlet and said, I would really like this collection to be more science fiction-y if you can. And as you know, you've obviously done some research before this, I'm not really a huge science fiction writer. Neither is Angela. We've both dabbled, I guess, but, most of the time we're writing fantasy or dark fantasy or horror kind of story. So this was a challenge, and it was something where we did kind of fret perhaps a little bit about how we were going to put together a collection of science fiction stories. And initially we were talking about trying to make it really science fiction-y, like set in outer space kind of thing, which neither of us have done before. And I'm laughing because it just, you set yourself challenges and you're like, yes, we're going to do it. But everything we came up with was not great. And I was just like, I don't know anything about trajectories and planets. And, our spaceship's probably going to be just smashing into planets all over the place because I don't know how these orbits and things, I love to read science fiction, but I can't claim that I'm a scientist. So after we realized that we can't actually, or at this stage anyways, we weren't going to do a kind of space opera collection, we thought what we're both really interested in terms of science fiction are, those kind of what if this happened in a real world setting. And so we decided to explore an Australian setting over various periods in time because that's something that interests both of us. And all of the stories have sort of at their core themes of you know, parents and children and babies and whether or not to have babies, whether or not you can have them, you know, so we're kind of speculating on the future of humanity in a very short collection. So I think that that was something that excited both of us to see, you know, what would happen if women could, like badgers, carry multiple embryos, but also decide when they would be born. You know, what kind of power would that give you or not? You know, so these are the kind of questions that we came up with as we were writing the stories. And so that's what drove us forward. And then, of course, collaborating. I mean, we have worked together on Midnight Moonshine and on other short stories. So we know that we can work well together, and we know that it's always fun and it's great to have that kind of collaborative partner to work with. So that was definitely, I think those three elements were really what drove us. I can't remember what the second part of your question is now. I've just blabbed so long.
That's all right. I was asking what do you hope it beyond entertainment, what do you hope it delivers?
Well, I always hope that the stories will deliver more than entertainment, but in terms of just having people think about them after they've closed the book, and I know that's such a, everyone wants that, it's maybe a kind of modest goal, but I don't think that we are, you know, setting out to create any new science fiction advances that will become reality, you know, or anything like that, but raising questions about, you know, procreation, women's rights, all those sorts of things, if people can start to or continue to think about them through reading our stories, then that's something I find really exciting as well.
Well, I think it's an admirable goal too. I think probably, you know, the best science fiction and to a lesser extent, you know, the best fantasy will do that, will leave you thinking about your life and what you contribute. So I think that's another interesting book. I mean, I will have got it anyway, hopefully, for Christmas, Santa Claus.
Yay, Santa!
Okay, you talked about your work with Angela and in general sort of talking about being part of a collaborative team. Mm-hmm. I won't get you to talk about how wonderful she is or how terrible she is to you.
Wonderful.
But I was just going to get you to say what advice would you give to emerging writers or, you know, writers that haven't done collaboration before on collaboration, on seeking to collaborate with somebody?
Well, definitely work with somebody whose work you admire. I think that's a really important part. And also somebody whose opinions you trust and value. I know that that seems like it should go without saying, but I don't think, I mean, writing is hard. Let's just come out and say it. And so it's hard enough when you only have yourself to contend with. But then when you have another person and their personality and their sensitivities or their whatever, you know, it's twice as hard, potentially. But if you go into it, so you're not going to just go into it with some random who you've never read their work and they just say, I'm a great writer, and then you go for it. But if you know you've read this person's work, you know each other, or you have some sort of acquaintance with each other, and you think that, you know, you'd be interested in writing something, you've got similar styles or interests or whatever, I think having that sort of fundamental connection is really important. And then also, once you've found, you know, a writing partner, realizing that it is a partnership. So you can't keep every sentence that you have written, and you can't keep every metaphor that you have invented, no matter how beautiful it is. And, you know, so you have to really be willing to let somebody else come in and go through your entire part of the story or draft or whatever you sent them, and be willing to let them erase it all, if that's what they want. You know, most people wouldn't if you're in a good partnership. But if it came down to, you know, that part that you just slaved over for the past 5 days actually doesn't work in the story anymore, that has to go, and you have to be able to let somebody else do that. And that is a really hard thing to do. So hence I go back to the trusting the person and admiring their work part. Because I think with Angela and I, we worked together at Clarion, and we knew that we gave each other feedback on stories and crits and, you know, edits that were in line with, you know, we had the same kind of work ethic and the same kind of editing style and things like that, and we were as harsh with each other as you could be and still appreciated it and weren't precious, and I think that that's all really important. But I also really love her writing style, so I know that if I give her, you know, a day's work, and she goes, oh, I need to rewrite that, that it's going to be beautiful. And I think that she, I hope that she would say the same thing about me, that if she sends something and it's like, oh, actually, what we really need the characters to do here is blah, then, and I rewrite what she might have slaved over for the past however many hours, that that's fine. So I guess it's about being open and really being open and not just going, yeah, yeah, I can work with a partnership because it makes the work, you know, half as much work. But that's not necessarily the case. I mean, it is. It's really great having a collaborative partner when you go, I know they need to get through the forest, but I don't know how they're going to do it, and I don't know what's going to happen. But I know what happens after they get out of the forest, so I'm going to write that part, and if you can fill in the gaps, that would be awesome. So it's really great to work with someone, but, you know, actually trusting them to change things, you know, that's the kind of thing where you have to really be free and let someone else play in your sandbox.
And I was going to add, is it a good idea to live in different states as well?
Possibly. A bit? No, do you know, because we communicate really well, I guess that's the other part. It's not just a matter of going, here's my, you know, 10,000 words, have at it. It's more communicating throughout the process as well, even if it's just a matter of communicating via track changes and the comment bubbles in Word, which we do a lot. So when we were writing Midnight Moonshine, obviously that's several hundred pages. It's not just one short story. So we were commenting on everything. And so when we would change something or if we cut out a section, we just put a little comment saying, had to change this because blah, you know, or had to tweak this because of whatever. So you always know what's driving, you know, the changes or the additions or the edits or whatever. And I think that that communication means that even if we weren't, you know, in different states, it would probably be, it would still just be as fine. We'd be able to talk about it in person more than through comment bubbles.
Fair enough. Okay, I'm shifting gear a bit here, and they're going to talk about some of your nonfiction work that you've written on horror.
Yeah.
You wrote a great article, I think it was last year, for This Is Horror, that focused on the Australian Gothic.
Yep.
And there was a strong sense of a landscape that didn't want the characters there or here, in mm-hmm. whichever perspective you're looking at. And it occurred to me, and this is, you know, I've reread it probably two or three times over the last year or so.
Oh, cool.
Did you think that that was perhaps a result of colonialism? And I'm talking here of mostly white Australian spec fic writers, but perhaps that there's a recognition, whether it's conscious or subconscious, that we still see ourselves as intruders or interlopers?
Well, this is a tough question for me as an interloper to answer. Because I'm Canadian, I think that a lot of my fascination with the Australian landscape and the Australian Gothic is that, you know, I almost like a twice removed kind of thing. You know, I'm from the East Coast of Canada where it's really foresty and, you know, dark and snowy and all that sort of thing. So for me, this element of the Australian Gothic and the horror being in wide open spaces and in the brightnesses rather than in the dark, dingy corners, that is something that I'm still trying to get my head around and I find fascinating. And, you know, so I don't feel equipped to be able to comment on Australian colonialism without completely revealing how ignorant I am about a lot of things. You know, I feel like I'll just stumble into some Canadian perspective on Australia that, you know, is not the most intelligent answer. So I know I'm totally sidestepping your question, but I just don't feel like I'm qualified to answer it.
No, that's fine. I don't think most Australians would be qualified to answer it either, I'm including myself in it. But no, it was just something that, because I've read a couple of non-fictions this year about sort of pre-Federation Australia. Mm-hmm. It's, I was wondering how that might tie in. But we'll move on then. That's fine. And this is the question I was talking about when talking about my own reaction to horror.
Yeah.
And the initial point of horror, I think, is obviously to horrify. And I wonder what aspects of horror you were drawn to as a reader. So what kinds of work truly horrify you? Besides bad writing, that is.
Yeah. Well, we'll just take that as a given. Bad writing is like, I think that personally I'm less inclined to pick up a horror book that's, you know, kind of splatterpunk, you know, horror about torturing people and, you know, that kind of, you know, things like you would watch Saw or Hostel or any of those sorts of things. That's not really, I'm kind of too queasy, I guess, to watch those sorts of things, although I'm really interested when people talk about, you know, what's happening and what the reasons are behind those sorts of stories. So for me, when I look for horror, it's the horrifying things, that what you were alluding to there, rather than necessarily all of the famous horror tropes. You know, also, I'm afraid of clowns and the dark and a whole bunch of things that actually make me such a chicken that it's so funny that I actually write horror stories because I'm the biggest scaredy cat in the world. So, you know, I kind of tend to avoid watching a lot of horror films because I get too afraid. I'm like a 5-year-old and I need to leave the light on. So when I read horror, I like it to be the kind of stuff that is chilling. You know, maybe it's more cerebral, or maybe it is like the way you were describing Karen Warren's story, you know, that kind of thing where you just think, oh God, it's giving me chills. You know, what is happening to these people? So I often, when I'm writing stories that are described as horror, it's usually the ones where I go, oh, these poor people. What am I doing to these poor people? Instead of, you know, I'm going to send them into a haunted house or have them go to Camp Crystal Lake and get attacked by Jason from Friday the 13th. But, you know, it's more, you know, they're in a situation where they have no way out, or, you know, horrible things are imposed upon them because of the world in which they live, or there are some sort of monsters that are going to eat their children, or, you know, so their future is bleak. You know, that's the kind of horror that I like to read. Like sounds awful when you describe it that way, but, you know, that I find really engaging. And so I think that's the kind of stuff that I end up writing as well, where, you know, it's kind of like the horror is happening on a subliminal level or just on a cultural level, or, you know, the way that the relationships are happening between people. So that's the kind of stuff that I go, oh, God, that's so chilling, the stuff that makes you just feel sorry for the characters. That's the sort of stuff that I find so horrific. So I'll continue to read it and hopefully continue to write it as well.
Oh, please do. Please do. Now, it's obvious, you've stated you're from Canada, the land of snow and nice people.
You've settled maple syrup. Yum.
And maple syrup. Now, you've settled in South Australia for the time being. Mm-hmm. What about Australia, its landscape, its culture, its people inspires you? Or, to put it another way, how have you seen your writing change since being here?
That is a good question, because my writing has existed only in Australia. But I find that I draw on imagery of both Australia and Canada in my work. I know that I'm doing it. Like, I can feel myself doing it. But I have to also say, Australians and Canadians are really similar in terms of temperament and worldview and all that sort of thing. So I found, you know, what inspires me, well, in terms of living here, it's a really nice place to live. People are, you know, Canadians are nice, but so are Australians. But in terms of just things, it's really landscape. So I know we were talking about this just a second ago with the horror gothic, you know, Australian gothic. I always find that it's kind of place or the world building that really feeds into, you know, my ideas about whatever story I'm telling. And I remember years ago having a discussion with, I think, Kirsten McDermott, and we were talking about, you know, do you get inspired by character first or world first? And at the time, I remember saying to her, well, it's always the world that inspires me. And now I've changed my tune, and of course it's characters and world and everything. But I always find why I think I like speculative fiction so much is because even if it is set in our world and it's about our world, it's also got that extra otherworldly aspect to it. And so when I'm here in Australia, it's such a different environment, obviously, than Canada, that I find that really inspires me. You know, we went up to Burra in South Australia a couple of years ago, this old mining town, and it's really small and it's really, you know, you drive up there and it's just brown fields, or golden, actually. They look like a nice ochre. But still, it's not like the kind of pine forest or maple trees that I'm used to driving through when you're on long drives. So even just that openness and then seeing these old buildings that aren't as old as something you would find in Europe, which is similar to me from being in Canada. You know, so there are all these overlaps and such huge differences in the landscape and in the environment that I find that always feeds into whatever I'm writing, even if it's not obvious. I think Bluegrass Symphony obviously seems to be set in a kind of pseudo deep south in America, but at the same time, there's so much in there that I find is from Australia, or I was inspired from places in Australia and also places in Canada, that it's funny that it somehow came out in this really solidly American way. So, yeah, I think for me, Australia, it comes down to the kind of laconic Australian view of a lot of things, the landscape, definitely. I've been writing a lot of stories with seaside settings lately, and it, that I find so strange because I'm not really a beach person. So all of the seaside settings are quite dark and grim, of course, but I think that probably has a lot to do with just how long I've been here now, and so the openness and the ocean and all that is starting to feed into my work.
No, I didn't know. So I'm thinking that's interesting. Well, you are in Adelaide, so you could go to the beach, I suppose.
Yeah, I do. I kind of sometimes go to the beach. It's just that I don't. Everyone laughs at me when I say this, but I don't really like fish in the ocean. I like to eat fish. I like them in tanks, but I don't want to go swimming in the ocean and have fish touch me. So that kind of prevents me from, you know, really enjoying the beach. But I do really like ships and boats and, you know, I like nautical stories and all that kind of thing. And I like going down to the beach for the day as long as I can hide under some sort of umbrella, because I'm also one of the palest people in the world. So, you know, there are all these factors that mean I'm not the biggest beach lover, but, you know, I do enjoy a bit of time just reading usually at the beach.
And then of course, there's the sharks.
Yeah, the sharks. But you know what? Yeah. The craziest thing is the sharks don't worry me as much because I know I'm never going to be swimming. So it's more the little fish that might come up and touch me that I'm worried about. Oh, I'm such a weirdo. You can leave that part in, even though it's so embarrassing.
Oh, that sounds like a great horror story.
Yeah, one day, God.
All right, to change tack again a bit, you completed a PhD in medieval Icelandic literature.
Yeah.
Which is not that strange, but it's certainly not probably the first thing that most people would think, you know, study medieval Icelandic literature, maybe even medieval literature. So what drew you to that particular period?
Yeah, it was strange that I even ended up doing that. I had no idea of, I mean, I've always loved medieval things. I've always loved the medieval period in a kind of medievalist, you know, way. I've probably through my love of epic fantasy in high school and all that sort of thing, but had always been attracted to the medieval period. So, but it wasn't Iceland in particular until I had finished doing an honors degree here in Adelaide. And I had a really great teacher that I actually studied Old English with. So I thought, okay, Old English, Beowulf, all that stuff, yep, that's really cool. I knew about that. But in the middle of that topic, he said, well, you know, there are also these great sagas written by medieval Icelanders. And I had never heard of them before in my life. And little did I know then that when I read those sagas that I would be so taken by them enough so that I decided to be an insane person and do a PhD on the sagas, which entailed learning Old Norse and, you know, reading and commenting on 40 medieval sagas because I'm, again, a crazy person. So it was just a kind of fluke. I was really attracted to medieval literature. I also loved, you know, Elizabethan literature. So anything like the older the better is kind of my approach to studying when I was at uni. And so when I encountered these Icelandic sagas that were describing the Viking period, and I found that so cool that I just thought, okay, this is something I had never heard of, but now I love and want to study, and ended up doing so for far too long. But But I still do. I mean, after finishing a PhD, I think most people that have made it through the PhD, you kind of feel a bit of fatigue with your topic. As much as I loved it when I started out, by the time I was finished, I was like, I hate this. I never want to look at this again. And then a year went by, and I went, actually, no, I think that medieval Icelandic sagas are just so cool, and there's so much interesting fodder, and, you know, they have that kind of really laconic, you know, maybe even Australian kind of, you know, the stoic male kind of characters that I find really appealing. So, and Vikings. How could you not want to write about Vikings?
Get no arguments from me.
So, yeah, it was a fluke. I stumbled into it and then stuck with it. And I don't see it going anywhere, considering my next book is set in medieval Iceland.
Yes, well, I hesitate to ask you about that, but no, it did sound interesting. I did read a bit about it. It's historical speculative fiction.
Yeah, historical speculative fiction. So this novel is going to be completely different from Lament from the Afterlife. It's going to be completely different from anything I've written before. Although I think it probably will have some sort of thematic similarities with bluegrass. You know, cowboys, gangsters, and medieval Icelanders have a lot in common. But anyways, so this one is set in medieval Iceland, and it's following the story of one of Iceland's first settlers, a woman named, sometimes she's called Aud, and sometimes she's called Un, and so I call her both in this book just to complicate matters. So it's following her story, her life story. And it's historical, but it's definitely going to be a speculative novel as well, in that the Icelandic sagas are just riddled with ghosts and, you know, strange occurrences and witches and prophecies and all that sort of thing. So it isn't a stretch to write this historical novel with some speculative elements in there as well.
Okay, so the speculative fiction readers amongst us will sort of see fantasy, whereas the perhaps as the normal people, or the norms, or whatever we want to call them, mundane, yeah. We'll see it, you know, a really sort of edgy sort of what do they call it? It's escaping me the term magical realism.
Yeah, that's probably you. I think you've nailed it. I'm hoping, anyways, that that's what it's going to do, that if the speculative fiction readers are going to go, awesome, this is a speculative fiction book, and the normals, are going to read it and go, wow, look at this historical novel with some magical realism. So, yeah, it's not going to be fantasy in a kind of epic fantasy kind of way. I think the closest one I can think of is Hild by Nicola Griffith.
Yeah, I was going to suggest that. Yeah. Yes, it was going to be some sort of similar.
Which is an amazing book. That's another one I'll recommend. If people haven't read it, God, it's such a good book.
Yeah, so I'm going to be poor after this podcast.
I'm sorry. I can't help it.
All right, well, to wind down and to finish off this wonderful interview that you've given us, as you've said, you've got a couple of novels on the go. You're still continuing to write your short stories.
Yep.
Is your creative writing work or relaxation or both? How does okay, I'll leave it at that. Do you find it to be work or relaxation or both?
It's both, I think. I think that I'm a type of person that I love editing and rewriting. That's my favorite part. Writing the story, I kind of go through bursts. Sometimes I'll be inspired for a story and I start to jot it down in my notebook, because normally I write my stories directly onto the computer. But when I get ideas, I have notebooks just filled with ideas and ramblings. And so sometimes, you know, you just get so caught up in a story that you end up writing the whole thing down by hand. So that's obviously really fun. But more often than not, the way that I do it is I've got all these ideas, I know what the story is going to do, and then the writing down of the story part's really hard. But then when it comes to editing it and making the story hopefully good, that's the part that I find really fun. So it kind of, you know, is the back and forth between going, oh, God, this is so hard. Why am I doing this? To you going, oh, I love this. This is awesome. And then, you know, obviously I am a creative writing lecturer at work as well. So part of it is work. But then I always find that that's the really awesome, fun part about work. And so it kind of, again, it flip-flops. So there's it ebbs and flows. Sometimes it's just really great fun and relaxation. But then not so relaxing, because once you get caught up in the story, I don't sleep very well because I'm thinking about it all the time. And, you know, you'll wake up in the middle of the night with, this is what needs to happen. He totally screwed it up. And, you know, so then that's a little bit not so relaxing. But, yeah, when it comes down to it, you've got the draft and you're editing it and polishing and editing, adding new scenes and all that sort of stuff. That's what I really love that part.
All right, then. Well, I'd like to thank you very much for agreeing to the interview.
Thanks for such great questions. It's been fun.
That's all right. And the bit at the end. But, yeah, and Merry Christmas to you.
I hope you get Christmas. Lots of books.
That means I'll have to read them.
I know. But, you know, sometimes just having them there on your bedside table, you'll absorb them by osmosis.